What's up, my freaks, sharpness geeks, and purveyors of static goodness? Welcome to the Knife Freak Show. My name is Jonathan McNeese, and I'm joined by my co-host, Mr. Chase Boatwright.
I am here. How are y'all doing today, guys?
Hope everybody survived the snowpocalypse that went across a good chunk of the country here.
Yeah. So there's still snow outside in my yard. I'm sure there is at your house, too.
But, a little bit, yeah. Most of it's melted off by now, but not too much. So not too much left. But that's the beauty of, for both of us, with, you know, your shop's right behind your house and our shop's at the end of the driveway, so we can both walk to work. So
yeah, I was still
getting snowed in is not too much of an issue.
No. I was still working while the snow was still falling, so
Yeah.
It didn't really affect me and too much.
Yeah, that's great. Like that's a definite benefit of working essentially from your house or from your property.
Yeah. So the only thing I was worried about is if the power went out, because our infrastructure's not built for snow in the south.
Right. No, it's not. Our power goes out constantly if the wind blows a little bit, or sometimes just on a bright sunny day. So I think it's just because we have so many trees so close to the power lines everywhere, and they don't necessarily keep them trimmed back the way they should, and little bit of wind and something falls on the power line. And anyway,
sure, but hope everybody that was affected by the snow is not too affected by the snow, and, back to work and all that fun stuff. But
yeah, hopefully it was a fun snow for everybody. We got to get out and play in a little bit and didn't cause any major disruptions. So
definitely
that's good. I will admit it wouldn't have affected me going to work either way, because I was actually on vacation this past week. So I kind of checked out for a few days. So we did end up cutting it a little short, though. We went up to the Smoky Mountains and actually made a visit to Smoky Mountain Knife Works. Did a working vacation where we went and had a meeting and did some other stuff there. So we which all went really well. Very tickled about that. But we we left a day earlier than we normally would have, because we were afraid we'd get snowed in there, and even worse, we were afraid we'd get snowed in and the power would go out in the rental, where we didn't have any way to any preparations or anything like we do at home. So and getting snowed in an extra day wouldn't have been the end of the world, but getting snowed in with no power would have kind of sucked. So
it's not cool.
So we headed on back, but it definitely didn't hurt me as far as work goes. But anyway, so I think we had an update on our news story that we've been talking about, and then one other thing to mention.
Yes, it's kind of the end of us talking about, maybe until, things actually move forward with the Crucible saga. Knife Steel Nerds, Laren Thomas, did a video on his YouTube channel about the Crucible shutdown or potential shutdown and the buyout, and explains all the processes in much better detail than I have been able to, because I don't know those processes as well. And obviously he does. So it's a very informative video that I would recommend y'all go watch. And, just that way you're all apprised of the best information that's out there. So,
And from what I gathered from it, we know about the same thing that we've been saying that we know, which is wait and see. And we'll probably have some version of the steels, including Magna Cut, whether they actually are named Magna Cut or not. That was kind of what I gathered from it. So,
That was sort of the gist of it, and it was also interesting to me just to hear, the roles that Niagara actually plays and the roles that Crucible plays and why, those things are important. So it was just an interesting insight into the steel side of things. So,
I definitely recommend to go and check that out. So,
And the other thing we wanted to briefly touch on is the thing that is, ticking down closer and closer every day, which is Blade Show Texas. It'll be here before we know it. 100%.
Yes, it will. And this is, we've done it the last 2 years now. This will be our third year. And we really like doing Texas. Atlanta is still the king as far as just the size of it and the scope of it. But as far as from us being there, working it, and where the show is and all that, it's a top runner for being our favorite show as far as being easy on us and that kind of stuff, as far as that part of it goes.
I'm very much looking forward to it. You've told me, and other people have told me, you got to go to Texas. You got to go to Texas. And this will be my first year doing it. Either I hadn't even been as a attendee of, you know, or an exhibitor. So very excited to, not super excited about the very long drive out there, but it'll be fun.
Yeah, it's a drive.
Yeah, especially with a 1 year old
car. It's not, it's not really a bad drive though. Lots of straight road, some pretty country. It's not terrible. So I'm looking forward to doing it again. I'm really glad that you decided to do it. It's a good show and it's growing as well. So that's, you know, getting in on it now before it gets any bigger. So you can kind of be a part of it as it grows, I think is a good idea. They're doing a really good job with all the blade shows and building them up. When I started doing them, I think there may have still been a Blade Show West, but it was different. Sorry.
Yeah, I know they had a Blade Show West in the past and then sort of resurrected it and changed it.
Yeah. And I think it's different. And I never went to it before when it was the previous, you know, before they stopped it and then restarted it. But from what I gather, it's a little better now. So,
that's good.
I think that's going to be good. So, I'm really looking forward to that. We don't have a lot of time left, but we'll get some stuff knocked out, try to have some special stuff for the show. And I know you got some special plans for it. So looking forward to that.
Yeah. All of a sudden I got real busy real fast.
Yeah. Yeah. That'll be good. We can kind of talk about our projects going forward between now and then. So I think that'll be good. So we had a topic that we wanted to hit on that had been kind of bouncing around between the two of us. So I'm going to let Chase open that up and we're going to talk a little bit about some stuff as far as how we do things.
Yeah, I wanted to sort of discuss the differences in being a knife company versus a knife maker in, you know, the various respects that comes out and like how we actually make knives. Cause the way I make knives, not how Jonathan makes knives now, it's how he used to make knives, but they're sort of taking different paths once you grow to the point where McNeese's company's been and, or is now and versus where I am, you know, sort of just 5 years in starting out. So, did you want to lead off or do you want me to go ahead and,
you can go ahead. So let's start with kind of like, let's just do kind of like a, we could get really bogged down in all the processes, but let's just do like a 30,000 foot view kind of start to finish when you go to make, say a new knife. So you're going to do a new design. So 30,000 foot view, start to complete a knife.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, for me, it's a fairly simple process. I can either draw it on paper with a pencil and I can even, you know, just draw it on the bar of steel with a Sharpie if I want and, you know, just go from there. And with a folder, it's a little more complicated than that. You know, you got to make sure certain things line up and do what they're supposed to do. But, you know, just for a basic, you know, for a fixed blade, I could draw it on a piece of paper right now, walk out to the shop, start cutting it out and have a profile in 30 minutes or so. And, you know, it's not a difficult process from there. You know, I would go to surface grinding and, you know, all manually, all, you know, by hand, drill the holes, chamfer the holes, grind the blade or, you know, heat treat and grind the blade, put handles on it. Like it's all sort of a fairly simple process in terms of like from conception to reality. There's not a lot of, I guess, pre-preparation that has to go into it. All you really need to know is what steel you're going to use and, you know, go from there. And assuming
you have the handle materials along the way.
Yeah. And once you, you know, kind of nail down the handle materials and, you know, blade material, you're, you know, off and running. And it may not, you know, come out exactly like you drew it because that happens. But, you know, it's fairly, I don't know, what would you say?
As far it's kind of a, you know, we always joked a lot and it's not, I mean, sometimes you come out with definitely more of a plan, but it's a little more of the whole like Bob Ross kind of deal where you just kind of, it's a little more organic. You just kind of, you know, if you want to tweak something as you go, then you can tweak it, you know, and then you can always go back and just kind of, you can basically make a pattern from your finished product. In other words, if you draw out a pattern, you lay it out on the steel, you start grinding it, you don't like the way something feels or looks as you're profiling it out, you can change it. And then, you know, if you want to be able to replicate that, you can basically just take the blank that you just did, lay it down, scribe around it, you know, or draw around it and make you a new template. to be able to repeat it or whatever. So it's a very kind of, you know, creative flow. Just, you know, it, there's not a lot of distance between the creative process and the finished product in a way. Like, it's just
definitely. And I kind of run into that even more, like, cause you know, I kind of do what I call like constant CQI, like Spyderco does their CQI program where it's constant quality improvement. Right. I even, you know, and I guess the C in there stands for constant, but like, you know, even in the same batch of knives, I'll change something. Like if it bothers me, I'll change it because I'm not going to sit there and not change it if I'm, you know, making it with my hands. Like if I want this choil a little bit deeper, I'll deepen that choil. I'll, you know, take that grind a little bit higher. I'll lower the grind on the next one, whatever, you know, may be. And that, you know, sometimes frustrates me on the end of like consistency, but I'm constantly chasing that, you know, I'm trying to make the knife in here and I'm trying to put it out on steel and handle material and stuff like that. So
you're just refining it. I mean, that's you know, and at some point you may get it as refined as you want. And at some, you know, you also might not, you know, you can, and you may have it where you think you want it. And you ever revisit that design years later, you may go back and change stuff about it. Cause I've run into some of that. Like,
I've done that too.
Like, what was I thinking? Like, why? Yeah. Like your kind of some of your design philosophy and stuff maybe have changed during that time. And so something you particularly liked, a certain design feature that you liked, you may no longer like anymore or whatever. So it's just, you can kind of constantly change it, but it's basically you have a lot of flexibility would be the way I would describe it. I think to do the process like you're doing where it's,
flexibility is definitely the word. I can move on a dime and do whatever, you know, pretty much instantly, or as instantly as my hands will make it go. So,
And like I said, then after the fact, you can make a template or whatever to a pattern to be able to make it as repeatable as with handmade stuff, you know.
Yeah.
That's part of the beauty of handmade stuff is that they very rarely are all exactly the same. I think that's one of the reasons people like handmade stuff over factory made stuff, because you get, you know, it's technically kind of a one off, even though it may be the same model and they may be almost indiscernible from one to the next, but really if you look hard, there's always going to be small differences between stuff when you're doing stuff by hand. So that's one of the cool factors about it. It's not cookie cutter. It's, you know, it's always a little bit different. So at least it was for me. I was never good enough to make things like 100% repeatable from one to the next when you're hand grinding and doing all that. Like it's hard to do.
Yeah. It's very hard to do. And like, it's one of those things I strive for and I try to go out and do every day. And like it, then my brain gets in the way and I'm like, oh, I need to change this. I need to do that. I need to, you know.
Yeah.
But
like I said, that's part of the beauty of it.
Yeah.
You know? That's the, you know, that's part of the reason I think that handmade knives are appealing to a lot of people. So, because they're not necessarily all exactly the same. So
I agree.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so, that's sort of from the knife maker side or like the, you know, I guess, custom maker, but
just, individual, handmade. Yeah, I would say,
handmade. Kind of that's better phrase, but and you know, Jonathan started out doing that. That's what, you know, he did until a couple of years ago, and then, you know, obviously he taught me how to do that, and you know, that's what I'm still doing today versus what Jonathan's doing now, which is more in just a lot of ways. But I'll let him sort of explain that process.
Yeah. So it's kind of like you talked about that you can make quick changes and stuff like that. And it's not necessarily, in some cases we can too, but so I'll just kind of give you the process that we typically go through if I'm designing something new or whatever. So typically I draw pretty much everything in CAD now. So everything is pretty much drawn on the computer. Every now and then I'll sit down with a pencil or whatever, sketch something out. But typically, because honestly, it's just kind of, I wouldn't call it, it's more just wanting to be efficient, because if I do it on paper, I know I've got to get it in the CAD at some point anyway.
Yeah.
And it's just, instead of going through the process of trying to make sure that I get everything replicated exactly on the CAD, like it's just easier for me to just draw it, you know, on the CAD in the first place and go from there. So,
I've always admired that ability you have. You can design knives that look like your knives in CAD. And I haven't been able to do that yet. I have to draw it on pencil, like on paper first for it to look like mine. Cause I've tried drawing them in CAD from start and they just, they end up losing something.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, it can be hard to do because you are limited, you know, somewhat in CAD as far as being able to draw all the little curves and everything the way that you want it to. That's when a lot of times you can tell when a knife is designed in CAD and when it's not. So, I try really hard to avoid that where I can. Sometimes there's still features that you can kind of tell were because of limitations that with CAD versus hand drawing or whatever. But it's a challenge. So I'll draw something up. The one advantage I have with, like, say, with folders is that, like he was talking about having to figure out if everything works or not. It's still not 100% bulletproof, but I can tell, I can get everything lined up, you know, move the parts, you know, rotate the blade and stuff in the CAD drawing and make sure that everything is missing where it's supposed to miss and hitting where it's supposed to hit. Now, that doesn't always translate. When you get into some of the really tight tolerances, like the stop pin locations and stuff like that, you know, it looks like everything's hitting perfect on there, but then you go out there and actually make the parts and all of a sudden the tip is way lower or way higher than you thought it would be when it's resting on the stop pin or because at least for me, and I'm far from being a, you know, expert machinist, but the real life is machining the parts to make them be exactly the way they are on your screen is not easy to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, and you're talking about sometimes a couple of tenths on a stop pin location that can make the difference between everything lining up right and it not. So, so that's a challenge. But then basically, actually, I've started now, usually if it'll fit on my little 3D printer, so like on a folder, it will always fit. I'll actually print off the 3D, the parts as 3D printed parts and then kind of assemble them. And I can see, you know, I can actually get a little bit of a feel for them in hand and that kind of stuff. So that's definitely something that's changed, been able to kind of prototype on the 3D printer.
Yeah.
And then it's a matter of, so before I start running stuff on the machine, you have to think farther ahead because you got to think about all the fixturing, how you're going to hold the part, how you're going to hold it through the first side, and then what's going to change when you get ready to do the second side. You got to have tabs of some sort to be able to screw the part down or hold it down when you flip the part over. So the way I do it is, and it's, don't know that it's the best way, but the way I do it is when I design a part, so say we're doing a blade. So I leave the blade, the material for the blank is oversized and it has tabs made onto it. That gets screwed down on a pallet. All right. And then the machine comes in there. As long as those, it's not actually a super precise location as far as when the screws hold it down with the tabs. It's not actually like 100% precise located, but because the material is oversized, it's kind of like having some dough rolled out and you take a cookie cutter. And as long as your shape will fit inside your dough, you're going to get the proper shape out of your cookie cutter. Right.
Yeah.
So it's kind of the same thing. If it's located good enough to be able to stay inside the material, then it's going to make the part out of the material. And then it's just going to remove the excess material around the edges.
Yep.
But then the tricky part comes in. You've got to think about the second op, and on the second op to be able to take it off and do the other side, you have to have a way to precisely locate it. Cause if you just turn it over and use that same process, just holding down with those screws that are not precision, then it's not going to perfectly mirror. Like it's not going to be perfectly precise. Because you're talking about very tight tolerances to get it precise from one side to the next and make it mirror properly. And there's different ways of doing it. What we typically do is have a couple of features, like on the blade, we'll have on the second op pallet, we'll have a pivot barrel in the pallet, made into the pallet, so that when you flip it over, we can put the pivot hole will get put in on the first op. So when you flip it over, the pivot hole will go on the pivot. And then you have to have another locating because that blade can still rotate, you know, from there. That locates that end of it. But then we typically use like the thumb stud hole where I put a pin in there so that it'll fit on the pivot and a pin through the thumb stud hole.
Yep.
And that locates it pretty precisely. There's other ways of doing it. Like some people use the tabs themselves and ring them out and use precision pins or whatever on them or precision fasteners to hold them down.
Yeah.
But we use pins on most every part. So like on the handles, it's actually kind of easier. So on the first op, same deal, the cookie cutter deal where it's just cutting the part out. And then we actually put holes. We usually use like the stop pin hole is one. And then if you've ever looked on the inside of a Mac 2, there's these couple of other holes that are the same size as stop pin holes, but there's like no reason for them to be there.
Yeah.
Except the reason for them to be there is that they're locating holes. So when we, in the second op palette, it has pins in all those locations inserted into the palette. So when you flip it over, you line those three holes up on those three pins, and it's very precisely located then. Mm-hmm. And then the holes through the tabs just hold the part down so it doesn't go anywhere. But those three pins are precisely locating it, so it mirrors virtually perfectly from one side to the next, in theory at least.
Yes.
So that's thinking about that kind of stuff ahead of time and figuring out how to, because it's more, once you get the actual part modeled up and everything's working together, that's almost kind of the easy step. Then you've got to figure out how to hold everything down and then what order of operations to do everything in to make everything work right, as far as, you know, milling out this pocket here and how deep can your weight reduction pockets go without, and then when you mill the other side, is it going to cut through and be too deep? Like when you put, say, the frag pattern in there, is the frag pattern going to cut into the weight reduction pockets? It's like, there's just a lot of stuff to think about.
And it's all before it's ever done.
Right.
That you've got to think about
that before you ever get to do one and hold versus, the finished product.
And I think that's how this discussion sort of came up before, is like, you know, I have generic fixture type things that I can just bolt something down to, but I don't have a CNC, so it doesn't have to be precisely located. I just line everything up based on whatever I'm doing for that particular thing. It's not a bunch of forethought. It's sort of like hitting the ground running, or, you know, like running as you're learning versus, like, you know, actually having a plan going forward. And, you know,
you definitely have to have a plan. It makes a lot of difference. And I'm way more geared towards doing things on the fly as far as the way my brain works. So that's not been easy for me to get used to that. But it's a lot of planning that goes into it. And then you've got to, and we can just take like some blanks of material and put them on the machine. But typically I go ahead and instead of doing that, I usually typically go ahead and get the parts water jet cut. So once I've got figured out how they're going to go on there, where the tabs need to be, so they're not going to get in the way of, you know, the profile and stuff. Another thing, like I didn't mention, like, so we try to fully profile everything as much as possible on the machine. Mm-hmm. So that, because I used to not until I got, I used to be way more comfortable and still kind of am, but coming from a handmade side, I wanted to, and I was very uncomfortable with the CNC because I didn't know that much about it yet. And so we would get stuff close on the CNC and then I'd be like, oh, well, we can just take that in there, the grinder, and finish that up or whatever. Instead of making my brain stop and figure out ways to do it on the machine, we would just kind of stop short and finish it up by hand, which is great. It's not that hard for me to go in there and clean up, you know,
one
where the tabs were, you know, we used to like cut the tabs off by hand, leave them real thin, cut them off and go in there and clean the ends up. But when you start hiring people and bringing people in and trying to train people to do that, inevitably every time, I mean, they can eventually learn and be trained, but you start having turnover and you don't, you know, and every time that somebody's learning it, they're going to mess some stuff up. And so, and even the best person that's done it for a long time is not ever going to get them perfectly the same from time to time. I mean, it's human error.
Yeah.
So it just, you know, and then if you end up, say you hire somebody, you get them doing it, they mess up several parts. That hurts. That's costly. And then, you know, they stay 6 months and they leave. Then you've got somebody else learning it and they mess up, you know, 15 or 20 parts. Like, it's just that cycle over and over again. So I got a lot better about trying to make sure that I could figure out how to do as much on the machine as possible. Still got some room for improvement, but so you've got to be able to figure out, like, okay, the tabs are on there. I've got to cut the tabs off. So like, we'll do everything, profile the knife, leave just the tabs on there, go in, put screws to hold down through the pivot hole and the lanyard hole or whatever other hole we have available to hold the part down while we go through and completely cut the tabs off. So the part doesn't go flying as you cut the tabs off. Like, it's just, there's a lot of steps to think about. I've hit the high points, but there's a lot to think about on them. So like, we'll take, design the part, probably 3D print it, have the water jet cut a small batch of parts so that we can put them on the machine, then you've got to actually make the pallet. We're talking about this pallet. Like, the pallet has to be made. It has to have all the holes put in the right places. It has to have the threaded inserts put in it because aluminum doesn't hold up. We make them out of aluminum. Aluminum doesn't hold up with threads. You got to put the pins in, the ones that get pins, and everything's got to be, you know, you got to make the pallet properly first, because your parts are only as good as your pallet. And so you got to make the pallets, and then you can start bolting down. And we do like little temporary pallets sometimes, where if we're just doing testing something or doing a couple of one-offs or something, we'll just take a little piece of aluminum, throw it up there, and it's not like the full-on pallet system. But anyway, it's all of that has to be thought about. And then you're talking about making changes and stuff. So some changes, it's pretty easy to do. Like if I just need to move the location of a feature or something like that, or I, like you said, make a choil a little deeper. Typically that's not something where we have to rework the whole thing. But sometimes it does come down to, okay, well, if we make this change, like we get hit up all the time, like, can you make some lefties? Well, yeah, I'd love to, except it's essentially like making a completely different knife. You know, no, I don't have to model up the actual parts again, but from the point that they're modeled, all the rest of that has to completely be done again, because you got to make new pallets. You get, you got to have a whole separate set of pallets for them. You got to do all the, you know, CAD CAM work to make the pallet, get it designed, you know, to put all that in reverse. So it's just, it's essentially like making a whole nother knife. It's just not as simple as just, oh, flip the part over and run it backwards. Like this, all the stuff to do with the pallet and the fixturing and stuff has to completely get redone. And all the, not all the CAM, like, because all the processes you're going to do are still there, but you've got to go in and reselect them, flip to the other way or whatever. Like, it's it's a lot
more involved than just. I mean, I can make a lefty. I haven't done it yet, but all I would have to do is just cut the lock bar on the other side and put the detent on the other side, and you know,
that, it's just a matter of remembering when you're doing everything to do it backwards. Like,
that's why I hadn't made a lefty yet.
Back in the day.
I know.
Usually, it would. A lot of magic marker, like drill this side or whatever, or don't drill this side to keep it straight.
So,
but,
like mainly I wanted to kind of cover this for the fact of like, so you guys know where we're coming from and we're talking about different things. And, you know, my perspective is sort of different from Jonathan's in his current day to day, but I mean, he also, you know, knows where I'm coming from for the most part too. But, that, and I also want to just say, like, not all, you know, Jonathan makes knives, I make knives, but we're not necessarily doing it the same, and not all knife makers and knife companies are the same and what are capable of doing the same things, I guess. Like,
And that even goes like from one handmade guy to another handmade guy. I mean, for one thing, different people have different tools. I mean, you know, different people have different machinery, different tools, and just different skill levels. You know, same thing with the, you know, manufactured knives. I mean, different people have different skill levels, different tools, different things available to them. So it's, you know, different. And sometimes people just come up with completely different ways of doing things.
Oh yeah.
You know?
100%, especially in this industry.
There's the finish line, and sometimes, you know, there's one person zigs while the other one zags, and they're not necessarily, sometimes they are, one is better than the other, but not necessarily. It's just different ways of getting to the finished product sometimes. So
definitely.
And of course you're always, with either side, but I feel like probably more so on the production side of stuff, you're always trying to look at efficiency and stuff. You're trying to, you know, you always, you want to be efficient if you're going to be successful running this as a business, whether you're doing it by hand or whatever.
But there are definitely some handmade guys who, you know, don't lean into the efficiency. They're just, they are bringing out the art in their mind, or they are, you know,
They're just looking at it more as an art, a craft. They're not even really focused on the business side of it, which is not bad at all. It's just, I mean, some of the coolest stuff out there comes from people that do that. Like, it's, there's definitely something to be said for that. But again, if, it just kind of depends on what your goals are, as far as, you know, what you're doing with your business, or, you know, some of those guys too are, it's not necessarily their business. I mean, it's a business, but it's a hobby. It's not their livelihood. So
that's the other thing with knife makers, is there's part-time guys, there's full-time guys, there's company owners, there's, and it, part-time guy can be better at knife making than I am as a full-time guy. That's entirely possible. It is possible.
And, there's part-time guys that have been doing it for decades, you know?
And that doesn't, you know, just because they're part-time doesn't mean they're bad or worse or whatever. And, you know, it's just a different thing. But so I think that about covers it on this topic. What do you think? Do you have anything else to add?
Well, I mean, we may revisit some parts of it at some point, and get, especially maybe this may spark some questions about some of the, you know,
specifics.
Techniques or different things that we do. Yeah, some of the down and dirty stuff. So, if you know, if you guys do have questions or want to know more about it, let us know. But and we can go more in depth in future episodes. But because it there is a lot to it. But yeah, I think that's for the overview difference between the two. I think that's probably good.
Yeah, maybe in the future we could do a knockoff of this topic.
Oh, there you go. I believe that was a subtle attempt at a segue there.
Subtle, yes. That's my middle name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So let me go ahead and say, I meant to say this at the beginning of the podcast, but we'll go ahead and say it now. There's a good chance that this is about to get not kid friendly. So if any of you happen to be listening to this in the car with your kids or anything else, be warned, at least for the next few minutes, there's a good chance there's going to be some adult language and such. So just be warned. So what Chase was referring to, some of you, I imagine a lot of the people that watch this podcast have probably seen the reel that I posted a couple of days ago on Instagram and on Facebook about knockoffs. All right. So naturally, we need to talk about it on here. So I know that knockoffs are not new, that they've been around for probably, I wouldn't say as long as the knife industry has been around, but they've been around a long time. They've been around as long as I've been in the industry.
I mean, like, as soon as they found, you know, like, back when they were having battles in, like, you know, Alexander the Great era, they realized, like, hey, this Kopesh thing works real well. We're going to start doing that. And that's how you got the Kopesh and the Kukri and all the other stuff that, you know, from the areas that he touched. So, I mean, like.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say that's a little different, though, than an actual full-on knockoff. What we're talking about is people, not just people like borrowing some design philosophy and stuff and some design features, but people full-off making fake counterfeit goods and trying to pass them off as the real thing. That's, to me, a completely different thing. And that, I think, has gotten worse over the last probably at least 20 years. And it's not just our industry. Like, I mean, there's the old classic, you know, joke thing or wherever the dude on the street in New York City with a black jacket, you know, opening it up with the watches, fake watches and all that crap in there. Yep. I mean, we've all probably been to places where and seen, you know, fake Rolexes and fake handbags and, you know, all the different stuff, anything that's designer and
premium,
typically anything that's kind of like luxury goods are the ones that it's not just that it's also sort of like an electronics and the, everything else. Like it's just, and it's usually smaller stuff like that because like, you know, probably pretty hard for them to smuggle, you know, knock off cars into the country, stuff like that. You know what I mean? It's stuff that can be typically that can be gotten into the country illegally because it is illegal to import any kind of counterfeit goods. It's also illegal to buy any counterfeit good or to pass any counterfeit good off, to buy, sell, basically even like hold like in your possession any sort of counterfeit goods. Yep. I looked it up and it's some pretty stiff penalties and stuff involved with it. So, it's a serious deal. I don't, you know, I think it's just such a broad, widespread thing that the policing it is very difficult, but, that's something I'm going to be looking more into. But so, like I said, I know that every, you know, well-known company out there and probably some even that maybe aren't super well-known have been being knocked off for years. It's not new. We've reached that point where we're now being knocked off. I knew it was going to happen at some point. And, you know, I've heard people say it's like a badge of honor or whatever. And like, well, I mean, yeah, I get where you're coming from. Sure. Like it's in one way, it's nice to think that, okay, we've gotten the attention of somebody, you know, halfway across the world that, you know, thinks our stuff is worth trying to make some money off of, but still pisses me off. It's still theft. Like it's not a badge of honor. It's 100% theft. So, let me just go ahead and say, guys. Number one, quit calling them fucking clones. They're not clones, all right? Clone makes it sound somehow like it's cool or somewhere. It's okay. It's not a clone. It's a counterfeit. It's a knockoff. It's a fake. That's totally what it is, all right? They're not just copying people's designs and or like we said in the beginning, taking design elements and, you know, this is pretty close to that design, but they changed a little something. They are literally copying the design as close as they can, putting our name on it, and when I say our, I'm not just talking about our company. I'm talking about everybody that's getting knocked off. They're taking and stealing our logo, our everything, and trying to pass it off as the real thing. And guys, that is a 100,000,000% theft. Like there's no way around it. All right. And if you in any way support that, if you're making comments saying that, you know, well, I can see where whatever is, so blah, 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 or you're buying them, or you're whatever, you are helping somebody to steal. You're basically complicit in theft. All right. And that's the way I see it. And just like I said on my video, you know, I said then that anybody out of our customers, because we get people hitting us up all the time wanting a favor for this or a favor for that or whatever. If I've seen that you've ever had any in any way had a clone, been involved in saying it's okay or anything else, you can fuck off. All right. I'm not helping you. I'm not ever doing anything for you. Don't even come talk to me at a show. I don't want to be friends with you. All right. And that goes for whether you've bought a clone of ours or a clone of anybody else's. Any clone. See, I caught myself doing it because this shit's done gotten so infectious. It's not a clone. It's a fucking knockoff. Yeah. If you've ever bought a knockoff of any kind of any sort and I know about it, I don't even want to talk to you. All right. You are not a person with decent morals, because it's completely immoral to be okay with knocking off somebody else's work and profiting from it. Guys, if these guys, and I hear them, oh, but the quality is, blah, blah, it's not about the quality. I don't care if they make a knife that's what you deem is higher quality than ours. Then if they're so good, why are they having to use our brand to sell their stuff? Because, guys, they're not just stealing the shape of the knife, all right? I have worked for 17 years, and this is just me. There's people out there that have been doing a lot longer than me that are getting ripped off, but I have worked for 17 years busting my ass, paying my dues to get to the point where people, where our stuff is desirable. And it's not just about the design. We have built the brand up. We have built a reputation. We have treated people right. We have promoted endlessly, spent who knows how much of my life promoting stuff on Instagram. Like, you guys see all the videos that I do. You all know my tagline, the What's Up Knife Freaks. Like, I have devoted a huge, huge chunk of my life to building this brand up and getting it recognizable. And then these people swoop in, and because they have the ability to reverse engineer stuff and some manufacturing ability, they come in and now they're making stuff, putting my name on it, literally my name on their knife, and passing it off as our stuff to make money off of it. And a lot of you are okay with it and are actually helping them do it. Like, how, in what world is that right? All right. And I've seen everything under the sun to try to justify it. I've seen, you know, well, I can't afford the real thing, so I just thought I'd get a taste of it. How is that getting a taste of it when you're buying a fake? If I go buy a Honda Civic and put a Lamborghini tag on it, does that mean I'm getting a taste of a Lamborghini? Like, that's just ignorant, guys. If you want a taste of the real thing, then come to a show, check it out, and save your money until you can buy one. Because I guarantee you, everybody that's listening to this, it may take some time, but you can save up enough money to buy a $600 knife. I guarantee you're wasting more than $600 in a year. Yep. Like, everybody out there, if they truly want to, if you're well enough off to be listening to this on your iPhone and everything else, then you can save up $600 in a year. And even if you can't, guess what? You might go some point of your life, you may go your lifetime and not get everything you want. Surprise. Shocker.
I mean,
you want to be like, such a poor little bitch that you think because you can't afford it right now and everybody else has got one and it's cool, that it somehow justifies that you can go buy one for $80 and now you've got one and you get to be part of the cool club. Well, yeah. Guess what? Owning fake shit is not cool.
No.
I don't care if it's a fake Rolex or a fake, you idiots are probably the same ones rolling around out there with fake Rolexes and buying your wives fake handbags and everything else and thinking you're cool because people are looking at you and thinking you've got some money or whatever. You're an idiot. You're a bunch of losers is what you are. And that's what anybody, look, I'm just going to go ahead and say it. Anybody, I'm not saying be like physically aggressive towards anybody, but I would encourage all of you that have any kind of decent morals, that anybody out there that you see promoting this, buying this, talking about that they're good, this or that, I want you to confront them, call them losers, call them whatever, because that's what they are. And the only way we can fight this is if we do that right there. If we attack, not physically, but if we go after and make it shameful to do this crap, because we're not, look, the Chinese culture is apparently, it's okay for them. All right. Like, that's just, we can't stop them from doing it. It would be like playing whack-a-mole even if we did. Like, we can't stop the stuff from being made and from coming into the country. That seems to be okay in their culture. I think they're just raised that, you know, it's okay if you want to, like, Chase, tell them the story you were telling me about the Spyderco deal.
Yeah. I don't remember where the video was, but at some point I watched a video where I think it was Eric Glesser talking about, like, where they were trying to find a factory for the Spyderco Tenacious before it started out. And the company owner was bringing Sal and Eric Glesser, like, by the hand, excited and pointing left and right over in the factory. Oh, there's a Spyderco. There's a Spyderco. See, we make Spydercos too. We really like them, as a point of pride, as a point of, like, they weren't shamed by it. They were bragging about it.
They didn't understand that there was anything wrong with it.
No.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Yes, the Chinese people or whatever that are doing this are to blame to some extent, but it's more the culture there that has, over the years, has made it okay to do this. It's just, to them, it's a legitimate form of business. It's almost like they don't know any better. Mm-hmm. All right. So, and while yes, it still pisses me off, and, you know, I'd love to be able to do something about it, realistically, you're not going to. But what we can do is we can make it not cool to promote this crap. We can make it not cool and make people feel like losers for buying this crap and supporting it, because that's what you're doing. We're not even getting into the whole, you know, you're actually helping support the Chinese Communist government with everything that you buy that they're doing and everything else, because that's also true. And I've seen people justify trying to say, you know, some of these more well-renowned Chinese companies or whatever. And when we get into the quality discussion and all that, and again, it's not about the quality, it's about theft. But how do you guys know that these companies that are the reputable Chinese companies are not also making knockoffs and selling them without you knowing about it? Does anybody have any way to know that? I don't know if they are, but it honestly would not, especially with the story that you just told me. I mean, so it's a company that they're looking at, you know, making Spyderco model for Spyderco, but yet they're already knocking off their stuff. Like, yeah. So you, and it's completely normalized over there. So you're telling me that these factories that have the capability to do that stuff are not taking advantage of that? Maybe not, but I'd be surprised.
Yeah.
So I'll tell you something else, guys. Like, on the listing for one of the knockoffs of ours, I think all the knockoffs actually that I've seen so far, you guys are buying them and talking about, you know, oh, they can do this for, they can use this steel, they can use MagnaCut, and they can use titanium or whatever, and they're putting them out for this price. Well, y'all are just price gouging us or whatever. All right. On the knife, on the listing, it says, I don't remember what the steel is. It has it listed on the listing as whatever steel, some cheaper, crappy steel, but literally says in the next sentence, marked MagnaCut. They literally are saying on the listing, they're literally telling you that the knife is made out of one steel, and they're lying to you and telling you it's made out of MagnaCut. And if they have so little scruples that they're fine with slapping somebody else, taking somebody else's design, slapping their that person's, the original designer's logo on there and passing it off as real, you think they're just going to automatically be honest about the materials that they're using? Really? Like, you're a sucker. You're an absolute sucker if you think that. So it's absolutely ridiculous. If you guys, I've also seen the argument that it doesn't actually take money out of the pockets of the knife companies, you know, who's being stolen from. Bullshit. Yes, it does. Are a lot of those people that are buying the knockoffs going to ever buy one of our knives? Maybe not. There's a fair chance they may not, because like I said, they're too, like, I got to have it now, and I'd rather cut corners and not save up and actually buy the real thing. But that's fine. We don't need them as customers. But guess what? These things get passed around. They keep it, or they show it to somebody, or it gets passed down the line, secondary market, whatever. And then somebody that's never seen one of our knives in person but has heard about them and want to check one out, they get it in their hands. They have no idea it's a fake. They check it out. They find something they don't like about it. Well, guess what? They may have been a future potential customer that might have spent thousands of dollars with us over their lifetime, and now are never going to give us a second look because their only experience with our knives was a cheap knockoff from freaking China. Mm-hmm. So yes, it does hurt. And on top of that, guess what? My company has already, this has just started with us. I can't imagine some of the companies like Spyderco and stuff. Like, we have already started having to devote time to answering questions, answering emails, answering DMs and everything else about, hey, is my knife real? Is this, how can I find out if this is, you know, a knockoff or whatever? Like, we have to spend our time, which is money. All right. It's valuable. We have to spend our time dealing with the repercussions of this and trying to help customers and know if they're getting ripped off or not and stuff. Yep. All right. Like, so if nothing else, it takes money from us from that. And guys, like, y'all may think that that's not a big deal, but you try running a company and doing all the things and your time being as stretched thin as it is, and all the emails that you already have to answer about legitimate stuff, and then start getting emails regularly about knockoff stuff and having to try to figure out how to explain it and how to check or have them send the knife in or how to, and then we've got to figure out what our policy is going to be if somebody sends in a knockoff. What I want to do is take it in the grinder and turn it into dust, and that's probably what the policy is going to be. So be prepared. And I'll make videos of them when I do, so make it fun. So anyway, we haven't decided exactly what we're going to do yet, because we obviously have to look out. We have to have legal disclaimers and all that good stuff. But it 100%, if nothing else, if a single person doesn't not buy a knife because of those knockoffs, it still takes money from us by us having to spend time dealing with it. And like I said, at the level we're at, it's bad enough, but I cannot imagine the money that Spyderco and Emerson and Chris Reeves and some of those guys are spending dealing with this stuff. Benchmade, yep. Like all the guys that are like, they're selling, you know, gazillion knives a year. Like, I can't imagine, not to mention the stuff that they've had to do as far as legal fees and trying to fight stuff with lawsuits and stuff. Like, it's ridiculous. But you, and some of you guys out there are losers enough that you just think that that's okay. Somebody in your community, whether it's me or whether it's these other companies, is trying to do something. They're trying to build something and provide good quality products and build up a brand. And you guys are okay with people, with helping people just come in and steal from us, steal our time, steal our intellectual property, steal our name. They're literally stealing our name. They're literally taking my name and putting it on something that they made that's not real. It's not something I made or approved. Like, in what world is that not theft? So if you're okay with these things, if you buy them, if you support them in any way, then fuck you, you're a thief. And that's how I see it. If you don't like it, don't buy our products. I don't give a shit. All right? Because I don't really care to have thieves buying my products. So that's it. There'll be more on this, I'm sure, as things go forward. And if I can find out any way to get a law enforcement officer out involved that actually gives a shit about pursuing this, then we'll go down that rabbit hole too.
Yeah.
But guys, this is serious. And one more thing on this note, this kind of takes us into another topic that we'll probably get into in a future podcast. But I've also seen multiple posts talking about basically villainizing the knife companies that are getting ripped off and saying that basically if they didn't charge so much, then people wouldn't be buying these cheap ones. They shouldn't be price gouging, essentially. Guess what, guys? We sell essentially luxury goods. All these knives that are getting ripped off and stuff are luxury goods. These are not knives that people are having to have to go out and, you know, live on a daily basis. I mean, yes, we all need knives and, you know, we can make the argument for that. But like, this is not like milk and eggs and gas. This is not something you have to get to and from work or to survive on a daily basis. All right. They're luxury goods. There's no such thing as price gouging on luxury goods. Luxury goods sell for whatever people are willing to pay for them.
Yeah.
All right. Number one, that's it. There's no price gouging. Number two, you guys have no idea what goes into making a knife, the cost of it. You truly do not, especially not production. Handmade knives too. I mean, it's a lot of it is more time, like the maker's time. Like Chase, like he could be out. What he has to weigh is how much he's charging for a knife, is his, how much time has he got in it. And compare that to how much time, if he took that same amount of time and went and worked another job that he's qualified to work, how much money could he make working that job?
Yeah.
And the way some of you guys act about pricing, you act like he's supposed to be able to make about $4 an hour, and that's what he's supposed to charge for his knives.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just about the material and the stuff that goes into it. This man's time goes into making that knife. This man's time could be spent at another job supporting his family, but he's choosing to do this job to support his family. And you're trying to say that it's only worth $4 an hour if you did the math and figured out what you think it should cost. And I'm not saying, I haven't even seen anything about Chase's pricing. I'm just saying generalized, you know, how some of you act about pricing.
Yeah.
And no, I've seen multiple people post, go ahead.
No, I mean, that's 100%. People want, you know, the price of the materials in their mind and basically, you know, a little bit of an upcharge.
Maybe like the price of the materials, you've got this much in it in steel, this much in it in titanium or handle material, some hardware, and maybe 10% on top of that.
Yeah.
You know what? 10% on top of that probably wouldn't even pay my power bill every month in the shop. Guys, you have no idea. Do you think these knives make themselves? Our payroll is our number one biggest expense.
Yeah.
So we have people that we support their livelihood by paying them to build these knives. We have payroll. We have machine payments on all these machines. Y'all would choke if you knew how much we pay in machine payments every month. We have insurance on everything, which again, you would choke if you knew how much it costs to insure a business and have workman's comp insurance and all the insurance that comes along with this. Like any one of those things alone would push the cost of the knife above the cost of the material.
Yeah.
Any one of those things alone would push the knife above what you're trying to say it should cost.
Yeah.
Like there is a lot of cost. And again, not to mention the time, like our time, not to mention the 17 years that I put into this to build this up to this point. Like there's a lot more to it than just the cost of the materials. Do you, again, back to all right, say a Rolex. Do you think the materials in a Rolex are that much more expensive than materials in a Timex?
Nope.
But how much more does a Rolex cost than a Timex?
Probably, I don't know, 10,000%, something like that. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't even know what a Rolex costs.
Maybe not quite that, but some of them, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I don't even know.
A few thousand percent at least. Yeah. Right. It's like, guys, again, just because you want something does not mean that it should cost what you think it should cost, whatever. Just because you can't afford it doesn't mean it should cost less. Maybe it means you just need to make more money. You ever think about that? Or maybe it means you need to quit wasting money on a bunch of other shit and going by Starbucks every day and spending $6 for a damn coffee and save your money up and buy the knife that you want. It's really not that expensive when you add up all the stuff that you're, all the coffee and candy bars and all the crap that you're sucking down that's just basically not even good for you anyway. Maybe not the coffee. I do like coffee. But
yeah, still. But I mean, on that note, like the guys that have a knockoff of one of yours will generally have a knockoff of a Hinderer, of a Medford, of a Protec, of an Emerson.
It's a pattern.
Yeah.
That's right.
So $80 times 10, I mean, where are we at? Like,
exactly. You could have bought one of those real ones by the time you bought all of those. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And guys, it's highly frustrating, as you can tell. Yeah. Like it's no different than if somebody came to your house and how would you feel if somebody came to your house when you ordered a new knife? Say you ordered one of our knives and it got to your house and a porch pirate came and stole it off your porch before you got there. You wouldn't be real happy, would you?
Nope.
So multiply that by about 10,000.
Yeah.
Because did you put 17 years into being able to get that knife?
No. I mean,
like, all the work, all the effort, all the things that depend on, again, like employees, like people's livelihoods, everything else, but people chipping away by selling fakes and doing this and you guys supporting them. You don't think that actually matters? And here's another note. I've seen people, I haven't actually seen any of them personally, but I have heard that there's YouTubers out there that are basically promoting these things and talking about how good they are and this and that and essentially promoting. Well, guess what? How long do you think it would take for one of these YouTubers, if somebody used AI and they started a YouTube channel and made the name the exact same thing as their YouTube channel, took AI, made a video that sounded exactly like them, made it look exactly like one of their videos looks, and started posting them up on YouTube under their name? How long do you think it would take for them to start crying?
Not long at all.
They would lose their shit. They would absolutely go crazy. But when it's happening to somebody else, they don't care.
Yep.
All right. And I tell you what, I'll tell you something else. All of you losers out there that are supporting this and buying them, I can guarantee you've never done one thing in your life worth anybody copying or doing anything. Because if you did, you'd feel different about it. You've never built anything. You've never created anything. You've never done anything worthwhile, or else you would understand the impact that this has. You would understand why it's wrong.
Yeah.
So just know that if you're supporting this, you can just go ahead and look at your life and know that you've never done anything worth building. You've never done anything worth anybody copying. And that's the only reason you're okay with it. So yes, people that buy and support clones, knockoffs, ripoffs, they're freaking losers, period. And that's the way we should all treat them. And that's basically it probably won't be my final word on it. I'm sure we'll talk about it again.
But, yeah, I'm sure this will come up eventually again. But for now, I think we should probably move on to something with a little more. I'm going to throw you a curveball here and jump down to a, excuse me, jump down and bring some levity back. Super glue versus Band-Aids. What do you prefer?
Depends on the cut.
Yeah, this is very true.
Highly depends on the cut. If you got a cut that doesn't want to stop bleeding, might possibly need stitches, super glue.
Yeah, yeah.
Like if it's just minor or whatever and it's going to stop bleeding pretty quick, whatever, Band-Aid for sure.
Yeah.
I don't want to take the chance of gluing my fingers together if I don't have to. So
that, yeah. Anytime I touch super glue and try to put it on my fingers, I mean, even when I don't try to put it on my fingers, I glue myself together to things half the day and, you know.
Exactly.
But
so, yes, but super glue is a wonderful thing. Like if you get a cut that's bad and it's questionable whether it needs stitches or not giving out medical advice.
Yeah, but no, don't. This is not a medical podcast.
If I get one and it's, you know, I don't really necessarily think it needs stitches, but it's also going to, it looks like it's going to keep bleeding for a while or something, or it's in a bad spot where I'm going to keep pulling it open by moving my finger or whatever. Yeah, super glue is the way to go.
So, yeah, I actually got super glue on my finger right now. So, yeah. All right. So, with that, I guess we'll jump back up to our freak of the week, our maker freak spotlight. And you had somebody you wanted to talk about for this?
Yeah. So, yeah, this week I wanted to highlight a leather maker. He goes by Three Sons Leather. Three Sons Leather Company is, and on Instagram, he's just Three Sons Leather Co. His name is Seth Robinson. And I had the pleasure of meeting him at the Maker Syndicate at the in Indianapolis this past year. And super nice guy. And I had seen his work before and admired it, but you know, meeting him in person made me pay a little more attention to it. I picked up a piece from him there, super cool, very well made piece. So like a really nice family guy, cool stuff. So
it seemed like recommend. I saw like I don't know, probably 20 or 30 people come back from that Indianapolis show with his stuff. Like a bunch of people like were posting about it and very impressed with it.
I'm not surprised. It seemed like we were a couple of rows away, but it seemed like he was staying really busy and stuff. So, and like I said, his stuff is it's got very like classy look to it to me.
It does.
It's more kind of refined, like very, very nice looking, very nice looking leather. It makes lots of slips and wallets and stuff like that. So, just really cool. He makes some belts and stuff. Really cool guy. Like I said, seemed to really have a lot of respect for the industry in general and stuff. And, seems to be trying to do things the right way and makes great. He does great pictures. Like his Instagram looks really cool.
It does.
Doing a great job on that. So
I was just perusing it myself.
What's that?
I was just perusing his Instagram myself and it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah, I've seen really his work before, but I had to
pictures and
it looks very good. So y'all go give him a follow. That's at Three Sons Leather Co.
Yeah.
So
check him out and pick you up some cool leather stuff.
Yeah, definitely. All right. So, up next,
we have a couple more questions.
Yes, we got a few. We were going to record the other day, but somebody decided to Hulk smash a microphone or something like that. I don't remember.
Yeah, I forgot about that. So yeah, I mentioned I was on vacation last week. Sorry, we missed a week, guys. We were really planning on not missing a week. We had more technical difficulties. I was gone. I took my laptop with me, took my microphone with me, and apparently did not pack it away safely enough. And by the time we got there, I thought originally I just messed the cord up, but I got a new cord and the microphone's still not working. So I don't know. Apparently I destroyed the microphone in transit. So we weren't able to do and that was our only option. The laptop I had doesn't have a microphone on it. So we had to skip a week due to my, brutishness apparently or lack of packing skills. So we're back with a couple of questions.
Yep. So from Jeremy J, or at 2WNDUP, he says, what factors do you consider most important when selecting materials for a knife and how do those choices affect the knife's performance and durability? So that's a very loaded question. I think there's a lot to hit there. I don't know. As far as selecting materials, I generally, as we discussed a few episodes ago, I mean, there's certain materials I think are good enough or they're acceptable, I guess. G10, micarta, I don't use a whole lot of woods because of that durability factor. Durability, I guess, is one of the most considered, like, important factors to consider when I'm selecting knife material. It's not just like, oh, well, you know, this looks good now. I don't care what it looks like in 10 years. That's not really my, you know, how I look at things and, you know, go about it. So, you know, as far as handle materials, I stick to the more, you know, try to stick to the more durable things. I have done a few things that aren't necessarily in that category. But, you know, there are, you know, I have preconceived notions, and sometimes I like to challenge those preconceived notions and do something and step out of the wheelhouse. So, but I would say durability is one of the biggest factors. Reliability as far as getting that material is important.
Yeah,
especially I would say that's, you know, in your line, it probably more so, because I mean, I can make one, I can get a one set of handle scales and use it on one knife and it not necessarily be a thing. And you know, you can too, you can do special one-off stuff, but you know, as far as reliable stream of sourcing that material is important. And just, you know,
agreed.
There's so many different places that, you know, I order material from. It's like, oh, this one has the green micarta that I like. This one has the black micarta I like. This one has the G10 that I like. And, you know, this one has the best prices on it. Do what?
Yeah, it's hard to get it all in one spot, which you ideally want to do. As a businessman, you want to, you know, you don't want to be paying shipping from three separate places and all that kind of stuff. But it's very rarely does it work out that you can.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, on the steel front, you know, mostly just, again, I like to use a variety of steels. I like to, you know, on certain knives, I want to do a batch of A2. And A2 is an acceptable knife steel for me. So, I mean, I keep it within the realm of acceptable knife steels, I guess, versus like, you know, this is a bar of steel I found at Ace Hardware. You know, I'm not, not going to do that, but otherwise I'm kind of all over the place on steel. So, I mean, it's more so what I'm feeling at that particular point versus, you know, sometimes there are considerations as far as the design. Like if I'm doing a big heavy chopper, I'm going to do something. I'm not going to do S110V. You know, I'm not going to do something that's very high edge retention, low toughness in that sort of application versus, you know, I'm not, a lot of guys do it, but I'm not going to do a kitchen knife out of 1095. Actually, I technically have done one, and I know you've done some.
Me too.
And I know they work really well, but I just...
maintenance, but yeah,
they require some maintenance factor.
As far as the performance, like,
Yeah, I mean, my favorite kitchen knife that I own is, well, it's not necessarily... I mean, it's 15N20 from the Jones Brothers, so... So it's sort of got a little bit of that stainlessness, but not really. You know, it's got that nickel in there, but... Right. Yeah, those are some of the factors I consider most important. What do you consider?
I'd agree with pretty much all of that. And like I said, the end use is part of it. You know, what you're going to, for sure, you want to take that into account.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's not necessarily the end use, but it can also be the, from the production side of the making side of it. Cause just like you said, you're not going to choose certain knives for certain applications. Well, if I'm trying to make some kind of like high end, you know, full Timascus hand rub blade on a folder, I'm not choosing S90V because it would be an absolute monster to try to hand rub it. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's going to be a steel that I can do a decent hand rub on. It will look good. It's not going to be a total nightmare to finish, like stuff like that. So the finish you're planning on putting on it at the end.
That's a very important one that I skipped over. Yeah.
Yeah. That can for sure help dictate it. And basically, like you were saying, acceptable steel. So like there's not many things that we realistically use out there that aren't good steels for knives or good materials, period. Like I said, wood, there's some handle materials that aren't great, but still there's knives out there that have held up for, you know, decades with wood handles. So there's not that many actual bad choices. Assuming that you're thinking about the end use of the knife and stuff, like you said, not using something without enough toughness to make a chopper or things like that. So, it also comes down to, for me, thinking more back along the lines of being a businessman, of also what the customer is going to buy. Because there's steels that I like you mentioned A2. I love A2, but I'm not going to sell hundreds or thousands of knives in A2 typically. Like our customers are just not going to support that. So I'm probably not going to use a lot of A2, but just because, you know, I need to be able to sell the knives.
Yeah.
So And so to a certain extent, I will look at the, what the market dictates, as long as it's not something stupid that's not going to function for the knife. You know what I'm saying? Like if it's a good steel, good handle material that is good for whatever knife I'm building, like the end use function is good. And yeah. it's just, you know, once it's kind of a toss up between this one's cool, but this steel's good. Like if one's more popular, then that's probably the one I'm going to use. Like yeah. it's just, that's just kind of the truth of being in business. Like you need to make stuff that people want to buy. Now, am I going to sacrifice, make something that's inferior quality, knowing that it's maybe not, that's going to affect the end use of it just because people like it? No, but honestly, that's almost never the situation, because people usually want like the newest, highest end, fancy thing. And so aside maybe from, like I said, some of the handle materials, but yeah. other than that, like
there is just, also like a, I don't know, sort of a niche where like they, some customers like sort of a throwback sort of thing, and you know, yeah, try to, you know, is. Do something some different, like
go against the grain too.
Yeah. Yeah.
If like, it's I know Hinder, popular, they don't want it. They want yeah. something else.
I know Hinder did like some 01 a few years ago mm-hmm. and like wood handles on, you know, and stuff. And like right. people were all about that, 'cause it was sort of like an ethereal feeling more than like a, yeah. you know, necessarily purely performance aspect. So, I mean, there's right. a lot of considerations when trying to
that's right.
figure out what the market wants.
That's right.
So,
and that is definitely, you know, if you want to be successful business wise, you have to take that into account. Like, yep. It's just the fact of the matter. So,
yeah.
so as long as it's a good quality material that's not sacrificing something as far as the end use of the knife, then yeah, customer preference definitely plays a big factor for us.
For sure. So yeah, I mean, and we kind of touched on it there, the performance and durability, you know, aspect. I mean, the design sort of I guess lends itself to the performance, you know, form follows function right. sort of aspect. And, you know, then from there you go into the heat treat, the geometry, all the other things. So, I mean, there's other factors I think that are more important in the performance aspect than just the material. Right. That's the one part where I think, you know, you can have a better performing knife out of, you know, M390, but you can also have a better performing knife out of 1095 if, you know, the geometry and the heat treat's not there, you know.
Right.
You
yeah, know, there's a lot of things like that. There.
So,
yeah, there's a lot of factors that enter in. And another one that it kind of goes along with what I said as far as like what you're going to do with it as far as finish wise and stuff, like the machinability and stuff like that is also a factor for us. Like,
yeah.
For example, like if we got something, we want to take the edges of something pretty thin, but we know that we're going to do a tumbled finish on them, which we do on pretty much everything.
Yep.
And those edges are going to be prone to chip out when we yep. tumble them because we took them so thin, then that's probably not the right choice of steel for us, you know,
yep.
stuff like that. So, I mean, it's, you know, there's things to consider in the actual making process as well
yep.
that, you know, so it's a few factors, but to be honest, not many people are, like you said, are, you know, maybe there's something to be said for choosing the right material for the right application,
yep.
end application of the product. But aside from that, like even if you put M4 in a folder, it's unnecessary. You're not going to be, you know, doing a competition chopping with a folder most likely, but it still wouldn't technically be a bad steel. It's still a very no. high quality steel.
Yeah. It's got very high edge retention.
Ideal for a folder? No, probably not.
Yeah.
But like, you know, it's probably got stuff you don't need and maybe trades that for some stuff that would be a little better for a folder, but
yep.
it's not like you're using a crappy steel just because you're using one that's not necessarily ideally suited for that particular knife.
I agree. You know, yeah.
Not many people out there are using actually truly crappy materials at this point. There's just too much quality out there. So, yeah.
All right. So that was a very good question, Jeremy. We appreciate that.
Yes, sir.
And next we've got a question from @ Old Man Bob Poncho. How you doing? And he says, as a small business owner, what's the number one best/worst decision you've ever made? Or I guess best and worst. I think I may have wrote that down.
Yeah. Now.
But
you want to field that one first?
Yeah, sure. best decision I ever made was to be pesky and annoying and keep emailing a certain knife maker, I think. That's probably the best one I've made so far. That was before I even had a business, but that, you know, sort of laid the groundwork for it. So otherwise, you know, I don't really know what I've done that well, but you know, I've done some stuff. And for the worst, I don't know. Whatever I screwed up most recently is probably my answer. And I don't really, you know, I mess up things a lot, so I don't tend to have time to dwell on the worst. I'm like a quarterback. I got to have a short memory and just move on to the next thing. I can't, you know, focus on what happened last week. I've got to just fix it and keep going. So
try to remember the mistake enough that you don't repeat it, but move on.
Basically, nothing is immediately jumping out into my mind of as far as like significantly, you know, been hanging over my head and causing bad ramifications for, you know, a long amount of time.
In your blood show application.
Oh yeah, well, there's that. So I may or may not be in Atlanta because somebody.
You can edit it out.
No, I ain't editing. I don't like editing. Somebody may or may not have forgot to fill out his blade show application for Atlanta, so yeah, we'll see if I'm able to still get in, but yeah,
it's gonna happen.
Yeah, hopefully. All right, so what do you got for best and worst decision?
All right, so the best one's probably fairly easy, and I feel like that would be, so my wife Amy has always helped me with the business, but she used to work a full-time job, and actually a really good full-time job. She left a six-figure medical sales position to come and work with me at the company full-time. And getting to the point, like setting that as a goal, pushing to get to the point that we could realistically do that, to get her to come on with the company, has for sure been the number one best decision that I've made, was to push and make that happen. Because, don't get me wrong, I didn't make her, but push to get to the point where that could become a reality, that we could afford for her to be able to do that, because it's made such a huge difference in multiple ways. It's made a difference in our personal life, because now, you know, instead of us kind of each doing, you know, she was always invested in the business, but when she had a whole nother career going herself, like, we talked about each other's stuff, but we were also kind of, you know, and obviously I was invested in her doing good in her career. She was invested in the business doing good, but you can't give it your full focus either way. Whereas now we're teamed up on the same thing, same goal, you know, we're all in on it. So it's, you know, it's been great for us. Like personally, it keeps us, you know, we don't have lack of stuff to talk about, because there's always plenty of business stuff to talk about. Like it's just, you know, and then she's phenomenal at what she does. Like she keeps everything running. She keeps all the admin stuff going. She stops me from making a lot of the bad decisions. Speaking of this question, she heads a lot of those off at the pass as I run stuff past her. Yep. She comes up with a lot of good decisions. She's, you know, phenomenal at dealing with customers and our vendors and stuff. So just has a really good head on her shoulders, and we mesh really good. We got really, really lucky, because I see a lot of stuff in books and stuff about companies where you need like the two main people running the company need to kind of not be opposites, but they don't need to have all the same strengths. Like they don't need to be just alike. And we're very much like that. Like I think one way, she kind of thinks another way. And so it works. We don't have both of us thinking the same way, which would leave holes in our game. Yeah. You know, that, so it helps a lot. So that would be my number one best decision, would be getting her coming to work with me full time. Worst decision, honestly, I'm kind of like you. I can't necessarily think of one individual decision that maybe waiting too long to, and I don't know if we've really talked about this. Maybe we will at some point, but on the journey from being back to the beginning of the podcast where we were talking about the handmade stuff versus, you know, production stuff, on my journey from going to there, I was very old school minded and thinking like that I had to pay my dues for some, I didn't really have a set amount of time, but like, I felt like I had to pay my dues. Like I couldn't just jump into having a knife company and doing, you know, production stuff or whatever, even though I really admired what some of these other guys, you know, I've talked about before were doing. Yeah. But so I feel like probably waiting a little bit too long. I do think that some dues needed to be paid. I think that's always a good idea, but I think I probably hesitated too long before I made the switch and got bold enough to actually, switch gears and try to start production stuff. So maybe that. Other than that, the only other things like technical stuff that I can think of. Now, I've screwed up. I've cost us so much money on screw ups on stuff, like it's unreal. Between messed up parts and making mistakes in judgment on waiting too long to reorder parts or reorder material that causes a slowdown in production, causes us to run out of stuff or whatever. But probably worse than that would be a couple of times in the past I've made some not great decisions on hiring personnel stuff. So that's just
one of those.
Yeah, I hired this crazy dude that wanted to make knives, and no, I'm just kidding. That was one of my better calls. But there has been a couple of times where I ended up kind of knowing that people weren't necessarily going to be a great fit, but I tried to force the issue because I felt, you know, kind of felt the pressure of needing help and made decisions that weren't necessarily the best decisions. And I say that being one of the worst things because the culture and the atmosphere in your company is, you know, when you get into a position where you have a company and you've got multiple people working here, the culture and the atmosphere and stuff is like a living, breathing thing. And it's extremely important.
Yeah.
Like if you mess that up, it can take a long time to repair and get it back straight and stuff. So, so allowing some people to be here that, and it's been more than once. I didn't just learn my lesson the first time, unfortunately. So, more than once I've let the need for warm bodies, you know, push me to make decisions that probably weren't the best decisions. And I think I've touched on before that we don't live in an area that has just tons of, you know, potential employees. Like we struggle to find enough people in the rural area that we're in. So
yeah,
I've let that pressure get to me before and hired people that weren't a great fit, not necessarily bad people, just weren't a good fit for us and what we were trying to do. So
that's,
like I said, that can cause more harm than you realize and take a while to unravel. So multiple things you could pick from on bad decisions, but that's a couple that come to mind. So maybe I'll be smart enough to not repeat them too many more times.
All right. So I had one last little question, and it's actually, it's something that's my fault more than anything, but it's Dano06472. And he says, are you still doing Apple Podcast or just Spotify? So on that's my fault. That's me dragging my feet. And I apologize to everyone out there who wants to listen on Apple.
It's me too. Cause I meant to have already talked to you about that. And
yeah, well,
I know there's some admin stuff we've got to do to make that happen. And I thought about it multiple times and I keep forgetting to text you. So
that's basically what keeps happening on my end too, is I'll think about it and
yeah,
there goes another day.
We'll get it taken care of. We're still figuring this out. I think Chase has got the thing figured out. We've just got to sign up for some stuff and jump through some hoops to make it happen. And that's what's held us back. So again, basically, please keep in mind that we're not professional podcasters, as I'm sure I don't have to remind you, but we're not even trying to be professional podcasters. We just want to have a somewhat professional sounding podcast.
Yes.
But so we're still figuring out, but we also do both still have, you know, mouths to feed and businesses to run and things to make and all that stuff. So just bear with us. So
yeah, we're trying. I use Apple Podcast as my primary means of podcast too. So I understand the pain, or I understand the need for that. So I will.
Yeah. We'll make it happen, guys. Yeah. Chase and I will talk after and sort out the details that we need to do to make that happen. So
yep,
for sure. All right. I think that kind of rounded us up.
Yep, that was it for questions.
This is our longest to date, I think. We're pushing that. Well, we're not close to 2 hours, but we're well over an hour.
Yeah. We stretched this one out a little bit, but we had things to talk about.
Something in ranting that happens, doesn't it?
Yeah. So you got anything going on in the shop right now?
Just basically getting ready for Texas. We do have we've got some cool stuff coming. We've got one. I don't want to say it until I post a picture yet, but we got something that has to do with anodizing that's really cool that I can't wait to show. That's going to open up a lot of cool possibilities for us. So,
is this something we've talked about before?
Something you actually sent me a link to at one point,
nice.
Which I don't think we actually used. Luke looked it up randomly Googled it. It probably was the same,
yeah,
same recipe or whatever, but he Googled it and cool, we tried it and it's working. So
nice.
Yeah, I should be posting a picture of that this week. So you guys look out for that. Yep.
I'm excited to see that too, because I haven't seen a picture of it either.
Yeah, I mean, I can send it to you. We've got several dealers that are lined up to get some stuff that we've got. We've got a couple of exclusives that we're working on that we've got to get done and out the doors to dealers, which is great. Seems like the market is already starting to open back up a little bit with us getting past Christmas and everything. So
yep,
really excited about that. We're going to keep listing some stuff on our site. So those of you that are, you know, that like to keep a check or whatever, we are going to try to keep a few things listed on our site pretty much all the time for the foreseeable future. So keep a check on there for that. And yeah, that getting ready for Texas, I think that and gearing up for the, I've already mentioned about a new model. I really want to have it done, at least a prototype done inside the first quarter of this year, which is going to be like, we'll be doing great if we do that. It'll be hard.
But, first orders it's
we're already well into it.
Yeah.
So like I'm fixing to order some handle material so I can get some blanks cut back to that process we mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
I've got all the programming and stuff at least initially done until I see what all screws up and what I have to change.
Yep.
We're working on some stuff on figuring out some stuff on blade grinding that I'm excited about. I'm going to have a buddy of mine that's a consultant is going to be coming down next month and helping me with some stuff. So I'll talk more about that as the time comes. I'm not ready to reveal all of that yet, but trying to work on a process that we can get this blade grinding maybe going in our favor a little bit better. Sweet. So, So, that's pretty much it. What about you?
Sort of same thing. I'm gearing up for Texas. I've got those five sets of my anniversary knives, or my anniversary sets is what I'm calling them. So working on, it's five sets of folder and fixed blades. I've been working on those and, you know, getting material ordered for some of those because I changed my mind on what I wanted to do with them and remaking parts and this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
Also working on about to send out some fixed blades to Urban EDC and working on some that I'll be shipping out to River's Edge Cutlery. So that's basically what I got going on. I kind of hit a rock wall on that surface grinder. I know I was sending you update pictures pretty regularly, and then I went to put it back together, and something was wrong, so I hadn't had time to dive back into it yet.
Hopefully it'll be something simple.
Yeah, hopefully. I got it all basically back together, and then it stopped spinning, and that's problematic, so.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's a problem.
Yeah.
Maybe just something didn't get seated quite right or whatever.
That's what I'm thinking. And I didn't really, I just kind of put everything back together to see, you know, if it would go back in, like, because, you know, I'm dealing with press fit bearings and stuff like that. And so, like, I wasn't fully expecting it to be my final time putting it back together. So,
right.
But
hopefully it'll just be something simple then.
Yep. All right. So well, I think that is about going to do it. We almost an hour and a half today. So
yeah, we got pretty close, which I mean, as long as you guys don't, you know, get tired of listening, then that's all right with me.
Yeah.
Sometimes we don't have time to do an hour and a half, but we managed it today. We're actually recording this on Sunday.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure when we're going to get it published, but we had a little bit of time today. But let's make sure, guys, to please, if you like what we're doing, you want us to see us keep doing it, please subscribe, please hit the like button. I know that we were talking about Apple and Spotify and all that earlier, but don't forget these are also on YouTube with video, which may make it worse, may make it better, depending on what you like. So, please follow us, please subscribe, all that good stuff, so we can continue to grow this. And you know, the more people listen, the more questions we're going to get, the more suggestions we'll get, like the better we'll be able to make the show and all that. And so, some of the stuff we're going to be talking about. We're already doing some educational type stuff with like our first couple of topics today with the differences in how we make the knives and that kind of stuff. And we'll probably get into some more technical stuff at some point of actual, you know, educational stuff on how things work, nomenclature, things like that. So
especially if any of you guys have like specific questions for us or, you know, want to hear us dive into a specific topic, you know, would be
right.
Happy really to dive into those.
Technical stuff. Yep. So yes, please subscribe. And also, we appreciate you a lot of you already do, but we appreciate if you keep up with us, our individual accounts too, on on Instagram and everywhere else. And we're just McNeese Knives everywhere, Facebook and Instagram and McNeeseKnives.com. So we appreciate if you check us out. Chase, give them yours.
I'm at Boatwright Bladeworks on Instagram, and boatwrightbladeworks.bigcartel.com is my email. And yeah, that's where I'm at.
Cool. And those of you that I know, we'll be saying it probably every podcast between now and then, but those of you that can, maybe are thinking about going to the Texas Blade Show or whatever, those of you that are going, we look forward to seeing you. Please come by and talk to us and let us know if this is painful to listen to, or if you're enjoying it or whatever. And if you are on the fence or don't know for sure about going, then I highly recommend going. It's a really good show. We've had a lot of fun the couple of years that we've done it. So really looking forward to it. Looking forward to Chase getting to go this year. So,
yep. Oh, also, our email for the podcast, if you've got questions and want to send them in email wise, you can always DM me and do it that way if you want, or Jonathan, I believe, but we have an email set up.
No promises.
Yeah. but we have an email. It's knifefreakshow@gmail.com. So knifefreakshow, all one word, @gmail.com. So
that's it. Well, guys, we hope you all have a fantastic week. Remember, clones ain't cool. Don't be a loser. We appreciate you.
See you guys.